Welcome to Wellbeing Akruwa podcast. John Lawyer's journey from the harsh landscape of desert combat zones to an inner battlefield marked a profound transformation from soldier to spiritual seeker. Now he stands as a guiding presence within Kishar, a non-profit online spiritual community fostering shared exploration of individual spiritual paths. Embracing the philosophy of omnitism, John revers the wisdom of diverse human culture and epochs. Through Kishar, he extends personalized spiritual guiding and coaching services, empowering others on their spiritual odyssey. And on today's podcast, we'll be chatting about Kishar. Our very welcome to the podcast, John Lawyer. How are you today, John?
I'm doing great, David. How about you?
Wonderful. So let's get this started. Where are you right now on planet Earth?
Yeah, right now I am in Oklahoma, which is where I grew up. I'm at my mother's house. I'm usually in North Texas, but for the past couple months I've been up here. My wife and I have been helping her out.
And what's Oklahoma like? I mean, can you make us jealous? Is it quite warm at the moment? Is it pretty pleasant? What's it like? So pretend you're on a TripAdvisor review at the moment. Give it your best.
Right now it's kind of one of those in-between days. It's kind of cool, not too hot. It's, you know, turning into spring. Oklahoma's a nice place. It's actually pretty geographically diverse. It's a pretty interesting place to have grown up. It's a little, maybe, you know, growing up is probably a little too conservative for my taste, but other than that, it's full of really pleasant, wonderful people, and it's an interesting place.
You've been very politically correct. Well done. Just making sure. So I gave a little bit of introduction about your background. So can you let listeners know a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I joined the Army straight out of high school, and that was right before 9/11. And the short of it is I would spend about the first, out of my first 15 years of my adult life, I probably spent 12 years in combat zones, Kuwait, Iraq, Afghanistan, and then kind of came home and had some healing I had to do and take some time. It took about 7 years. Then about 2 years ago, I had a kind of a spiritual moment of clarity, understanding, and knew that I wanted to kind of create an online spiritual community nonprofit. And that's what I've been doing for the last 2.5 years, every single day.
And can I just ask, like, what was it like? I mean, in the Army, did you have any passion to join the Army, or was that just a natural process back then?
No, so growing up, I'd watched Lawrence of Arabia. It really fascinated me. And I was like, I want to do that. You know, I want to go see that part of the world and interact with those people. And I read, you know, Tom Clancy, Jack Ryan novels, and I wanted to be in the intelligence community. So no, it was a thing that I kind of wanted to do. I wanted to do counterterrorism and try to figure out why people did what they did and try to idealistically make the world a better place, I think, back then when I was young.
And is it like the movies and the novels that you mentioned? The counterterrorism bit.
You know, sometimes it is. It's more paperwork than all of that. And there are definitely exciting times. There's definitely stuff that is kind of movie-esque that is pretty exciting. But there's a lot of boring parts. But I did love my job. It was exciting. It is one of those be careful what you wish for things, because I ended up in the Middle East at war for years. So it was more interesting than I could have ever imagined. It was darker than I could have ever imagined. I made great friends and met people that I, you know, would know and love for the rest of my life and that kind of thing. So yeah, it was a mixed bag, I guess.
What would you say, like, to anybody listening to the podcast? I mean, I've been to Kuwait, Iraq, and I haven't been to Afghanistan, but generally, if you give somebody an overview of what these places are like, because Kuwait for me, I thought the city was beautiful, and there was different parts of Iraq that I had been in, but I've never been in Afghanistan. But if somebody was to give a picture of your life in that environment, I mean, were you generally out in the desert specifically, or were you a bit of a mix?
In Kuwait, I had a very diverse experience. Since I did counterintelligence, I was a counterintelligence special agent. So one of my jobs was to go out and talk to people and meet people and discover things. And so I got to wear civilian clothes and work outside of the base. And I even lived out on the economy in the city for a while. And I was in and out of the embassy. So I had a really interesting job. And I got to meet Kuwaitis. I got to meet the third country nationals from all over the world that worked there. and go out in the desert and have desert gatherings and, you know, eat, you know, Kuwait desert barbecue with them. So, yeah, you know, it was a really multicultural experience for me. And you're right, Kuwait is a beautiful city. It's and they really loved Americans and Westerners, you know, Brits and the West from having liberated them from Saddam back in the early 90s. So there was a lot of goodwill there, especially from the older, you know, the generation that were in their 30s and above that still remembered the liberation of Kuwait. And so, yeah, it was a really rich experience in Kuwait.
It's quite an unusual, because I'll be honest with you, but I had a stereotype in my head, because obviously when you watch certain media channels, you kind of get this picture, because all they really show you, some of them, is kind of like the bad parts or what's happening in the bad areas. But when I seen the city myself, I was like, wow, this was, you know, some high rise buildings, some wonderful lights. It was very impressive. So would you regard yourself, John, as a career part of this, if anybody's wanting to get into working in the army or counterterrorism, I mean, would you regard yourself as a good reader of people? Could you know if somebody's kind of lying? Was that part of your passion? Because you can kind of figure people out.
Yeah, I think I had that gift as kind of naturally as a person. And we were taught to hone that skill as counterintelligence special agents. And so, yeah, I think being able to read people, and I mean, part of our job was even to sometimes manipulate, which isn't the best thing in the world, but you think you're doing it for good reasons, you know, because you're doing it to support your work.
Right.
And, but yeah, I would say that I am good at reading people. I think it's a natural talent and one that was developed with my military training as well.
So let's move on then to Kishar. So you mentioned there that you had, like, was it a spiritual moment that you had that kind of led you into this path? Is that what happened?
Yeah, you know, I think we're all on a journey, whether we know it or not. But I didn't know I was on a journey at that point, like a spiritual path. And it was completely unexpected. So yeah, I was laying in bed with my wife one night and she was asleep, and the universe just kind of clicked for me. It made sense. And it was a very loving kindness situation where I felt the oneness of everything, that we're all connected. And I knew what my higher purpose was, which was to kind of help people help themselves, and shared my journey. They can share theirs with me, and maybe we could ask better questions, see better answers, and practice philosophy or our faith or our spiritual ideas right next to each other, even if we believed in different things, that kind of thing.
And did your wife, I mean, did to try and make a bit of humor out of this, did she say, like, what's going on with this guy? Because you're, you know, one side of the coin and then it's flipped over the far side of the coin. Or have you always been that type of person where you're kind of, you want to help others and you'd be quite spiritual? Or was this a total shift?
It's a good question. I wasn't a spiritual person ever.
Right.
But I was a very kind person, and I was always pretty positive. I always had a pretty positive outlook, and I was always very kind to people. Not, you know, I had my moments, but for the most part, I was really kind.
Right.
And my wife had always been a bit of a spiritualist, as kind of her base setting. And so because of that reason, it was a kind of a very easy transition for her to become a co-founder with me of our nonprofit and, you know, help run our spiritual community together. So it was actually a pretty natural thing for her.
So can I ask, so somebody as ignorant as myself, and I don't mean I'm ignorant because I want to be educated, but what is Kishar? What is it? What's the idea behind it?
The idea behind it was to create a place where we felt like there was room for authentic, meaningful connection in the digital world. You know, that there's that just because we're kind of all living in different places and kind of away from our home communities, and there's still a place where we can connect with each other and explore our path together, you know, and say, you know, you can believe what you believe. I don't need to tell you what to believe. I don't even need to show you what to believe. Like, you get to decide what you believe and be empowered within yourself. Maybe we can throw some stuff out there that has worked for us or other people, but, you know, you decide what works best for you. And if you already have an idea of that, then strengthen it and explore it and develop and move forward in your own path. So we wanted a place where if you were a Hindu or Christian or New Age spiritual or even an atheist, you'd be able to come and have a community where you could have conversations and discuss subjects and have meditations and all this stuff that also looks at how do we walk our spiritual path every day, but also look at very closely how it intersects with the real world? You know, we've got all this lifestyle stuff, you know, health and wellness and fitness and relationships and finances and all that. How does it all fit together, you know?
Did you have any like cynical people that maybe when you went on this path to kind of say, oh, what's this guy up to now? I mean, was there any resistance or were you just 100% focused? You didn't care what anybody says, like the white noise you kind of put aside?
I like that question. I've never been asked that before.
Okay. The reason I ask that, John, because you know yourself, is that it's great what you're doing. It's when you have people from different backgrounds, different spiritual beliefs, different values, and you're trying to bring them all into one and trying to get them all to respect each other. Did you have any resistance to that? Maybe from one side of a religious belief or people that believe in the different values?
I didn't. I had a couple of people that were skeptical of what we were doing that I knew that were close to me. But for the most part, we had pretty overwhelming support. And I did have kind of what you were talking about, which is I kind of was, I just was blocking out any white noise around me because I was super focused on this. I was very determined to work on it every day. And to make it, you know, sometimes when you have those ideas at night or you have a new resolve, you say, I'm going to change my life tomorrow. I'm going to eat better or get fit or I'm going to go get a different job. You the next day comes and you don't do it, right? I was resolved to like to do it, you know,
yeah.
Kind of like an iron resolve. So I had that as well going for me.
And with Keyshar specifically, I mean, how did it start? I mean, did you start by setting up a website? Did you start by putting out posts on social media like Facebook and LinkedIn and so on? So how did that process actually start to get others involved?
Yeah, that's actually really interesting because since I kind of had this newfound understanding of the universe, but I had never really studied spirituality, I had a lot of learning that I had to do so I could be able to talk to people, right? So the first thing I did was, yeah, I jotted some ideas down about, okay, here's how this could work from an administrative perspective, from a technical perspective, from a creative perspective. And then I went in and read like 60 books in 4 months because I needed to understand how to talk about this with all different kinds of people and understand what this would look like from kind of a creative perspective. And then with that knowledge, having learned and educated myself, we kind of laid stuff out on, all right, here's what the website will look like. And here's what some courses that we offer for members, monthly members, and here's what we'll offer every day for like guided meditations or a daily affirmation, daily conversation topics where we can just kind of riff back and forth with each other on a text app or on our desktop computers, you know. So it was all that process that involved creativity, involved technical aspect of how to actually create the website, make sure there's an app available for it where people can access it. And then the administrative side of like creating a nonprofit and doing all the stuff with the government that you have to do. So yeah, there was a lot happening all at one time with it.
And what type of people then? So we speak with probably individuals or groups that might have different religious or spiritual beliefs, but what type of people are attracted to what you're doing with Keyshar? I mean, are they looking for something else? Are they lost in life? Are they looking for guidance? Is that what it might be like as well? Or is it something totally different?
No, it's like that. I think it's a mix. It's people that are looking for something and they're a little bit lost. There's people that kind of have an inkling of what they want to do, kind of a notion of what they want to do, but that's not fully developed. There's people that know they would like to be more spiritual, but they have no idea where to start. Right. And from their background perspective, you know, it's people that could be, you know, have been driven professionals that are stay-at-home parents, or, you know, it's people that are kind of looking for that, I think, that alignment of their mind, body, soul. You know, how can they live a more calm and peaceful life where they're happier and then the people around them are happier, right? Because I think it starts with ourselves, right? Suddenly, if we're living a better life, we're loving ourselves, we're doing all these things, and suddenly we're lifting up those people around us as well.
So what would you say to somebody like now that's listening to this podcast, for example, and you'd like them to get in touch with you or reach out to you to experience the Keyshar community? What would you say to them to kind of as a first steps?
I would say, you know, go check our website out and see if what we're doing resonates with you. And there's a good chance that it probably will for a lot of people. And ask yourself, you know, what are you looking for in life? Do you know what your values and beliefs are? Are you familiar with what your higher purpose is or your dharma? We work on that quite a bit. And if you know what your higher purpose is in life, and that's probably unique to you, are you living that every day? Are you living that way in your day-to-day life? Are you living that way in your job? Are you doing that with your hobbies? And then there's all this other work that we do to help people as individuals, whether it's finding gratitude, you know, working on habits and routines, looking at the process of letting go, which I think is a very spiritual part of being spiritual and walking that path, you know, finding forgiveness for ourselves and others and living in non-judgment, all these things that help us live that life where we're going to be better for ourselves.
It is then, you know, if you have individuals or groups that have different beliefs, I mean, how do you maintain that respect then within the group that to keep them all aligned with what you're trying to do? I mean, do you ever get any, I wouldn't say conflict, but do you ever get any disagreements where you might have one religious belief or a different person or individual or group has different values? How do you keep that all aligned?
I find that doesn't happen very often. And what happens is, I think most people that come into this concept, this idea, this community, they're pretty open-minded about life and the world. They have a kind of curious worldview, where they understand that regardless of religion or spiritual philosophy or faith or even hard philosophy or self-help construct or whatever it is that people kind of use to guide them, that we're all saying very similar things. You know, we're all pointing into a very similar direction, and that it's okay for us to disagree. I think that's, you know, our community has very few rules, almost none. It's really just be kind and be open-minded and respect what other people are doing. So it's pretty simple stuff. And I think most people that come in understand that. And it's a method and a way for people to grow within themselves and be who they want to be, empowered within whatever they want to be empowered with. And at the same time, they can say, I have a community to support me. And I also don't have to believe anything based on X, Y, and Z religion or spiritual construct or philosophy, because I can kind of decide what works best for me, even with, you know, even within a religion, right? You have to follow the dogma of that sect of that religion or that tribal part of that religion. Or even in spiritual communities or constructs, sometimes in New Age spirituality, people can get a little dogmatic. So it's about knowing that you can really believe what you want, develop your own set of practices and rituals or whatever you want to call it, to find that connection to yourself, if you want to call it yourself or the universe, the divine, God with the big G or little G, the Brahman, the Tao, it doesn't matter, right? It's the many names of whatever that thing is.
And do you have any stories, John, of people that have, you know, found Kishar, that they've actually found it so helpful? I mean, have you had any good feedback or positive feedback?
Yeah, I have. I think people find it really practical to have a place where they can practice what they believe and be supported in that, but it's not in this like overly serious way. I think I've known people who have found their higher purpose or their dharma and been able to align that more with their daily lives. There's people that have, in exploring themselves, have discovered that they've had some darkness or trauma in their past that they didn't even know was affecting them, that they've been able to figure that out, and then go find support in that. There's stories about people coming in and their lives getting better. I mean, that's what we're about. We're about, what can we do to help you live the life that you want to live? It's not the life that we want you to live. It's the life that you want you to live. And part of that process, maybe you figuring that out, and maybe you want some help doing that. But at the end of the day, it's your choice. And so I think people feel very they gain confidence and they start to see that there's other people that share a worldview or think not necessarily like they do, but in ways that are similar enough that they have something in common.
And just the word itself, the Kisha, where does that originate from? What's the meaning behind that word specifically?
So Kishar is the Sumerian goddess of Mother Earth or Gaia. And the word in Sumerian also stands for the line on the horizon, which we kind of think beautifully encapsulates the journey that we're all on. So it's both Mother Earth and it's the journey, the horizon. And we picked it because nature is really important to us. There's that really calming kind of divine feminine energy that I think is very peaceful and calm. And it just kind of felt right.
No, that's cool. It's really, really cool. The other thing I want to ask you as well, you mentioned that sometimes, you know, maybe if an individual is reaching out and they may be in a dark place or they're looking for a bit of guidance or uplifting. I mean, as a separate topic altogether, do you think sometimes, in your own opinion, that in the world that we live in, is it better to lower your expectations so you don't, how would you say, you don't get into that dark place? Because failure is good, John, is it?
I think failure is important, right? I think failure, we're always learning. We should always be learning. So I think failure is an important part of learning. If we don't fail, I don't think we learn. We don't grow. I think failure is important to growth.
Is then the say, individuals or groups, I mean, are they looking for something that is beyond reach? And possibly that's why they're looking for a bit of spiritual guidance, if you understand me.
I think I may. I think people are often reaching and working towards something that isn't necessarily their goal, but maybe it's society's goal or yeah, culture's goal or their community's goal, stuff that they've been taught since they were children, you know, by their parents and teachers and friends and coworkers and jobs and everything. So I think sometimes we're chasing that. And I guess in America, we call it the American dream.
Yeah.
and I'm sure there's other words for it in other countries. But the thing is that your dream? Are those your values and beliefs that you're following? I think there's an aspect of, we very rarely get to the destination that we think we're going to get to. A goal that we get to rarely looks at the end when we get to it, what we thought it would look like. And so I think we have to definitely ask ourselves, what do we want? What are we reaching for? And also what's really, truly important in that is, as I'm going towards this thing that I'm led to believe that I love and want and need, am I enjoying the process of getting there? Because if you're not enjoying the process of getting there, then I think we're really missing out on the whole point of life.
Is the age kind of demographic, I mean, the individuals or groups that will come, are they varied? Is it, you know, mainly men? Is it mainly women? Is it certain age? Or is it everybody?
I think it's probably more, just slightly more women than men, maybe like 60-40, 65-35 women. Age-wise, it's probably 30s to 30s and 40s significantly. And there's some, you know, demographics on both sides of that as well. So that's a kind of a rough look at what it would be.
Do you think, John, that, you know, with the age, as an average, like... And for the women mainly, do you think because men sometimes were a little bit more, we have the kind of like the ego that, you know, I don't need help and I don't need any spiritual guidance. I don't need to reach out to anybody. And then with the age being a bit 30 to 40, do you think, I was probably sounding a bit jokey, like, but do you think like midlife crisis, people maybe are a bit lost at that age? Maybe they've had certain things happen to them before the last, say, 15 or 20 years. It could be divorce, it could be bereavement, it could be anything. Yeah. They're trying to find some sort of guidance.
I do think with the men, it is kind of the ego gets in the way sometimes of going and finding that true spiritual thing that is like your base self that's deep inside you that is kind of introspective. And then from the 30s and 40s perspective, yeah, I do believe that, you know, in the 30s, in our 30s, we really start to grow up, you know, right? We start to have gained some wisdom, right? Because knowledge gained through, you know, then having experience with it, that creates wisdom. And so I think we start to have some wisdom in our 30s and we start to figure some things out. I think we also start to realize a lot of that stuff we're told when we were kids is like, well, no one ever told me that I was going to be an adult and I was going to have to make all these decisions and I don't know what I'm doing and no one knows what they're doing. No one told me that no one knows what they're doing. No one told me that.
It's true.
And I think, people start to figure that out.
We're winging
it,
John. We're all winging it. That's what it is.
Every day.
Yeah. And Professor Friend used to say to me, he says, "Oh, Dave," he says, you're winging it there, because what happens is that when you look at somebody that's successful, I suppose, and as you said correctly there, when you're younger, you kind of see all these, you know, wonderful actors or sports individuals and they're winning medals and they're achieving, and you kind of go, oh, I want to be like that. And then you realize, you know, sometimes a lot of luck is involved. So you can work as hard as you can, but life happens. And sometimes you might get injured, you might get sick, you might have a family problem, have a financial issue, and it kind of delays your progress to where you may want to be in life. But as you said correctly, nobody tells you this stuff.
Yeah. And when you realize it, you're like, well, damn. Yeah. Now what do I do? then you realize you've got choices. I mean, like, I think in our 30s and in our 40s, we start to realize we have these choices. We're making these choices. And suddenly we realize, oh, maybe I can write my own story instead of living someone else's story. And I think that's a big part of it. There's that realization. And I think that's why people call it midlife crisis or some terms that are similar to that, because there's that realization that I got here by all my own choice for the most part. Even if I was not making choices and letting other people make choices for me, that's a choice, right? That's abdicating responsibility to someone else. And so suddenly we realize that we have power, that we have the ability to make these decisions and these choices that take us wherever we want to go. And that's pretty scary, I think. To know that we have that power in ourselves. And so I think that when we get into this age of 30s and 40s, there really is a lot of introspection that can happen. And it could take us a lot of different places. People can handle that kind of knowledge and that kind of understanding or awareness in a lot of different ways.
As we said, the clock is ticking. It's don't waste time.
That's right. Always.
I want to go back a little bit just to kind of get a listener a little bit of understanding of how you kind of became to understand the universe. So you mentioned there you read 60 books within a space like a 4 months. But what type of books did you read during that period? Was it just spiritual books or was it just everything?
I set up a system where I would read I would read like a book on Hinduism, a book on Buddhism, a book on the Abrahamic faith, a self-help book, and then like two philosophy books, and then a general religion book, like on something about an indigenous tradition around the world and like pagan beliefs. And I would kind of, I had like seven or eight like genres, and I would kind of rotate through those, like in a line, and then flip back to the beginning and do it again. Cause I wanted to kind of see the world, the whole world, and I want to see it from around across time, you know, because I feel like there was all this, and I intentionally tried to read, like, if I read philosophy, I read two philosophy books, I would try to read a philosophy from like a Western white dude, and then I would try to make sure I read a philosophy for a woman or a person of color or something like that, so I was getting a more diverse view of the world.
And you know when you were saying you were understanding the universe, do you think your time when you're in the army and you're in the Middle East and you're in Kuwait, Iraq, Afghanistan, do you think that gave you a different perception and outlook that if you didn't have that experience, if that makes sense?
Oh, I know for a fact that if I hadn't been at war for all those years and in all those places, that I wouldn't have probably found myself and found the universe. I think that being part of the Western military industrial complex and seeing the darkness in it over the longer I was in it, the darker it became, right? Because you start to see things. I think that being able to see the darkness, understand that the machine's grinding you up, but you're also a part of the darkness. The enemy isn't quite as much the enemy as you thought it was, you know?
Yeah.
And all those types of things. Seeing all that darkness, being a part of all that darkness, I think it gave me a good perspective eventually, this would be years later, of being able to see the light, you know? And understanding there's this tremendous balance in the universe, and that I think us as living human beings and other forms of nature, plants and animals and stuff, I think we're the balance of the universe. We're, especially humans, we're in between the light and the dark. And if we accept the dark and know it's there, we can still walk that balance, but we can turn our gaze to the light. And I think that if I hadn't had that experience with war and being in combat zones and taking part in all that, I don't think that I would have walked at all the same path that I've walked.
Do you think, John, this is a personal question generally, but is humanity, in your own opinion, in a good place? And based that on what you've just said there, and obviously your experience that you had in war in the Middle East, kind of evaluating everything, do you think it's in a good place?
I will say that I have great hope and faith in humanity, and I think we're going to be okay. And I honestly think that the world is in pretty good shape right now. I think that we have war, we have famine, we have disease, we have conflict and all that stuff. But I think the world's a much better place now than it's been, you know, 200 years ago.
Yeah.
I think a lot of statistics prove that people have more access to education and literacy and medicine. And I don't think that we're an evolved enough species at this point to not have war. I hate that for us. I don't hate very much, but I hate that humans aren't there yet, but we're not as humanity. And that's okay. I think I have to accept that. I've had to do a lot of work myself, not being nationalistic and not listening to those geopolitical teachings that I learned all those years about, you know, China bad or Russia bad, US good, you know, and all that. Like, yeah, we're all just humans, you know, we're all just humans. And so I think, yeah, there's war, there's conflict, but there's people living in peace. There's people having children and living good lives and being healthy. And there's all this great stuff happening all around us. And so, no, I think the world's in really good shape.
And did it make you cynical at all? Because if you're in the middle of it, and the reason I'm asking these questions as well, just in case anybody's listening to this and they're in a similar situation where, you know, the stereotype and the media kind of push is that, you know, this is good and that's bad. And they're now involved in an area of expertise or an area of defense or anywhere like that, where they're being told that they're good, but they can actually see, well, actually it's not so much the case. It's a bit of good and bad both sides. I mean, did that make you cynical, and how did you manage that?
I became very cynical. It became very hard for me to look at because I started, you know, the longer I was, you know, all of my experience in Kuwait, Iraq, and Afghanistan was formative, but I was in Afghanistan for 6.5 years consecutively.
Wow.
It's a long time.
Yeah.
And during that time, I mean, for lack of a better way to say it, I was a hunter of men, and that was my job, was to pick targets and send men and women to go get them and to drop bombs on them. So either capture or drop bombs. And I became very jaded at our unit's job was to protect Kandahar Airfield, which was the busiest runway on planet Earth at the time.
Yeah.
You know, there was always, it was just massively busy, and there was 50,000 people on base. And our job was to protect the airfield, to protect the planes, protect the people, probably in that order. And in doing so, we had to go out and target those guys that were trying to stop the airfield from running, that were launching rockets or placing, you know, explosive devices or driving truck bombs up to our perimeter, you know. And the longer that we were there capturing all these people and ripping them away from their families and sending them away to prison and, you know, dropping bombs on people and ending their life. I think that, yeah, it really seemed like such a waste. Yeah. And it did make me cynical, and it did. I think there's people that go and fight war and they don't ever accept that we're not the good guys completely. And those guys probably sleep better at night. But, yeah. You know, that wasn't me. I began to see the enemy as just trying to live their life and put food on the table for their family and all, in a lot of respects, get us out of their country that we've been in for 20 years. And it also makes you question what we're doing running around and getting killed. You know, I lost friends in Afghanistan. And it makes you question why you lost your friends and why we're losing all these other men and women that are out there. And so it became a situation where I very much, it kind of like got to my soul, you know, it kind of cracked my soul a little bit.
And I mean, the families, I mean, did you build up relationships with some of the locals in Afghanistan, for example, or I know you mentioned Kuwait before, but was that hard to do, or was there a certain amount of being cynical as well because you're there to do a job?
Well, in Afghanistan, most of my time I spent in an operations room, like kind of directing people what to do. So I was not out and about with the people as much as I was like in Kuwait or even Iraq. And when I was there, so I did meet some senior Afghan security officials, especially in my early time there. And I would go and meet, and we would meet them as sources, our special agents and myself. And I would go to some of those meetings with some of these. And I had a police colonel who was I would say he was a friend. You know, you're not supposed to be friends with sources, but he was a friend. And then, you know, a year and a half, 2 years later, he was assassinated, you know. Yeah. And after that, I stopped meeting sources because that, when it wasn't my primary job, it was ours, but it was the agents that kind of worked for me. It was their job. And I just didn't want to be connected to them anymore, you know, because I knew things were going to happen to them. So, yeah, it was. I almost turned away from meeting people because I knew that they were risking their lives because they kind of believed in what was happening in their country, and they supported what the US was doing there in the West and all the Western nations. So I did turn away from that more the longer that I was there.
So I'm sure your wife is delighted now to have you home.
That's an actually really interesting part of this story. She was actually with me in Kuwait, Iraq, and Afghanistan for almost all of this. There was a couple of years that we were separated, but for the most part, she did a very similar job. She was an analyst. I was a special agent, and she was an analyst. And so we worked side by side all these years. So
you're the James Bond, John, and your wife is Miss Moneypenny. Is that what it is?
It is something like that. Yeah, it's something like that.
Oh, that's brilliant.
James Bond with a lot more paperwork.
So. A lot more paperwork. Yeah, you don't have the Aston Martin either, or the
no, it's the gadgets. No Rolex.
No Rolexes or gadgets. But that's why it's brilliant talking to somebody like yourself, because it's you get more in depth of what your career was like and how you come on from the other side and what you're doing now, which is really, really good. A lighthearted question I want to ask you, and you don't have to answer because you're obviously counterintelligence, but are there UFOs?
You know, I don't know. I've seen some pretty strange stuff. I saw some pretty strange stuff in Kandahar in my time there. But you know, I don't know. I tend to believe that there is life out there in the universe. But based on I have a top security clearance, but I never had the need to know for aliens. So I don't know. I tend to think that there probably are, but I don't know it.
Well, listeners, we don't know whether he's telling the truth or not, or whether he's just playing the role as a counterintelligence. So it was a good answer anyway. So John, have you any events coming up now or activities planned? And generally, how does it work then? So say, for example, I'm coming to you right now tomorrow and I go onto your website and let's have a little nosy. So I come to you, go onto your website, which is tshore.org. Is that correct?
That's right.
And you have, I can see you can sign in, you can choose a plan. So how then does it all work? Is it generally online, or do you do face-to-face, or do you do groups or events? So sell yourself now, John. This is a business.
Sure. I got you. So yeah, you go to tshore.org, and there's 2 monthly membership packages that you can get. They offer, one offers a certain number of things, and the second one offers all those things plus a few more. And so you can sign up for monthly membership. We have guided meditations. We have courses on how to, you know, be grounded and centered in your lifestyle. We have conversation topics every day that we chat back and forth on our mobile app and our desktop app. And it's a really fun experience. We also have weekly kind of Zoom meetings where we have the spiritual roundtable. We discuss spiritual subjects and stuff like that. We have a book club and things like that. And so that's kind of our monthly membership stuff. It's really fun. People really enjoy it. It's a kind of a, there's no ads, there's no trolls. It's kind of walled off from the rest of the internet, which is kind of healthy and nice. And then there's also, we offer individual spiritual guidance and coaching. I call myself a higher purpose and transformational coach, but I'm really just a guide. And we offer 6-month packages for that. That's one-on-one individual Zoom calls. And all the revenue, all the profit from this goes back into the community. My wife and I and our other co-founder who lives in Bosnia, none of us take a salary. And so we're just trying to give back to the world. And I encourage people to kind of take a step for themselves and come explore it. If they have questions, reach out to us via the website. Our social media handles are there. If you're just looking for a starting point, we have a pretty cool YouTube channel that has just basic ways to kind of walk that path and do it in an easier way. So check it out. And then, you know, reach out. You can always email or direct message on Instagram or whatever you want to do.
So we have your website. I'm just making sure I have everything correct. You have Facebook, LinkedIn, you're doing Instagram, Pinterest, Twitter, YouTube, as you mentioned already. And you're not doing any dancing on TikTok, are you?
No, it's all very standard. Just me talking to the camera videos. It's no dancing yet.
Oh, good. That'll come eventually. All this happened to say, thanks so much to John Lur for talking today on the Wellbeing Improver podcast. Once the podcast has been approved by John, it'll be placed on all your social media platforms. And all this happened to say, thanks so much, John, for chatting with me today.
David, you're an awesome host. I really appreciate the message you're putting out in the world as well. So thank you so much.
No, well done you. Great job.